I'm going to begin by doing something that no Southerner would ever do as an honored guest. I'm going to make a wager. I bet that there is someone listening to me now who yesterday witnessed no conversations with anyone. This man is balmy, you will say. Maybe, but one thing must be obvious. I must be using an unfamiliar notion of conversation, and indeed I am. And my deepest conviction is that you should be using that notion also. But you might think my question is a bit odd in any case, so I need to get some things out of the way. We are interested, are we not, in how to live, not in how to survive, but how to live a whole life to the best of our abilities and in communion with fellow human beings. The notions that I shall underline come from Aristotle, from Cicero, and later on from Adam Smith, whose sources were indeed the same. In English, they are embodied in several terms, most of which today sound both feeble and old-fashioned, certainly not the weighty terms they used to be. Indeed, they were almost ominous during my own childhood. The adjectives are suitable, fit, proper, appropriate. And the associated terms are decorum, moderation, harmonious. In 17th and 18th century France, where a great deal of thought was given to these matters, the terms were politesse, bienséance, honnêteté, and complaisance. To generalize the point, the criterion of appropriateness applies to everything we do. Not only is there a proper measure of all things, of which we are too often ignorant, but our responsibility to discover and live by it follows from our inescapable duties towards our fellow human beings. Southerners absorbed such views, not directly from the French aristocracy, but from their anglicized bourgeois adaptation, and most particularly from Scotland, where they were entirely severed from the duty-free zone of high society. Now, there are several other matters, of course, which ought to be discussed at length, but which I shall have to put on one side, except for a passing mention: rural and urban living, agrarian or mixed economies, small and large communities, traditions and change, cultures and multicultures. But like you, I have in mind all the time the two sets of essays of 1930 and 1936, a little before and a little after my own appearance on this globe. So let me unravel the metaphor in my title: What Cements Society? Are we clear what cement is, what it does, how, when, and why? Cement is a versatile compound with a complex chemistry. Composed of different constituents of different proportions, it's capable of binding together other materials under various conditions and with remarkable strength. The short answer to whether a particular cement will work is, it depends on the context. Sometimes other adhesives will do a job equally well, although in the long term the consequences may be unknown or undesirable. For example, araldite, yes, araldite in tubes, was used to bond elements of the Sydney Opera House roof, although no one knew what the behaviour of the adhesives would be in the climatic conditions. You may wonder why I know that. I just happen to have written a book on it. That enables me at once to signal my destination. I'm going to urge that the necessary cement of society in which we are interested is conversation. What I say about conversation and the nature of a desirable society go together, because crucially, we shall be talking about scale and values. We shall therefore also be talking about manners. The values were not invented in the South, and there's nothing unique about them. But the agrarian societies of the South did and can exemplify them as well as anyone anywhere else. We shall need to recall what Southern societies absorbed from European practices of the 18th century, and in particular, how the Scottish influences differed crucially from the French and are immune from the strident present-day rejection of something called the Enlightenment Project. Firstly, there's no core set of ideas or practices that defines anything called the Enlightenment in the various European centres. Secondly, some American scholars from and of the North have assumed that whatever happened in the South was inevitably on a negligible scale. And some Southern scholars have assumed that European influences were unitary and essentially derived from London. Both assumptions are false. I want to begin at the back door, as it were, by talking not about conversation, but about written texts and what we must often do to establish their meaning. My authority is none other than Lawrence Sterne in Tristram Shandy, dating from 1759. That central date, in so many ways, Handel had died, the greatest English composer, though born in Germany. Dr. Johnson published Rasselas 6 weeks after Voltaire had published Candide. Adam Smith published The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And the editors of the Encyclopédie were arrested just as volume 4 was about to go to publication. Here is Tristram Shandy. Writing, when properly managed, is but a different name for conversation. Several coordinates are needed to identify the context of writing: personal, historical, political, philosophical, religious, geographical. The publishing details and reviewing practices. Who were the intended and the actual audiences? Who responded to what, how, when, why, and where? Most readers use what they read for their own purposes in the present, and the further they are from the date of composition, the less they're inclined to detect original intentions, meanings, and implications. But can we sharply separate notions of interpretation and use? Because all texts operate within generic and rhetorical conventions peculiar to their contexts, and a knowledge of these is necessary to determine what meanings were derived by contemporary readers. Meanings only operate contextually, with the same words conveying different messages in different contexts. This makes the task of interpreting texts sound difficult and fraught with uncertainty, and often it is. Historically, as we must all remember, texts supplanted oral communication only in the last couple of hundred years, and for a minority of the world's population. Two-thirds of the world's population still lives in oral societies. What we now witness in the richly self-indulgent West is a new oral society, albeit technologically and materialistically driven, but worst of all, one not grounded in the duties of tradition and historical understanding. But I now ask you to think whether the familiar challenges about interpreting texts also confront conversation. And the answer surely is that they usually do not. And this is because we have all learned over many years the social and culturally embedded conventions which characterize conversation in our contexts. Let me emphasize the phrase social and culturally embedded conventions. There are obviously class, age, and gender differentiations in many contexts. And the variations between communities and nations can be great, as diplomatic misunderstandings endlessly reveal. I recently asked some Middle Eastern postdoctoral students if they knew the meaning of an everyday European saying. No one had a clue. The saying is this: when in Rome, do as the Romans. The speaker was St. Ambrose, who became Bishop of Milan in AD 374. I don't know whether Marco knew him. No, he's too young. In those days, Rome was another state. I then asked the students what they regarded as a conversation. And the women gave an entirely different account from the men. You will find a similar diversity of answers among any minority, ethnic, or original groups of people in North, Central, South America, in Europe, Africa, India, China, Australasia. So we should be careful. Unlike most politicians, whose linguistic competence is rarely evident and whose historical understanding is hard to detect. Learning is at the center of our socialization as human beings. Only from other people can we learn about the practices, attitudes, and beliefs transmitted from one generation to another. In brief, about our culture. That was always one goal of formal apprenticeships throughout history. Moreover, there can be expression only when there is both content and skill, something to express and the command to achieve it. This is because skill is a necessary condition of merit, and knowledge of the inherited traditions is a necessary condition of justifiable departure from them. Contrary to the seductive lie trumpeted from the 1770s onwards, artists cannot afford to be ignorant of other artists' work, because what has gone before provides the conditions of both understanding and merit. Artists are neither solipsists nor ego trippers. Let me divert you for 1 minute to think about music in Scotland in the 18th century. What was it like? Who made it? When and where? What were the contexts? In the Calvinist church, of course, there was no music, nor were there pictures or statues or colourful adornments or silver or gold or heating. And anyone thought to have been dancing or even laughing was viciously treated. Other features of life deepened a sense of imprisonment, because almost no one moved around. There was no single proper road in the whole of Scotland until 1750. Tracks, yes, and mud. The very few people who ever travelled more than 10 miles in their lifetime walked. Or they could go by boat, or worse still, if they went by farm wagon, they encountered the statistical fact that at least one axle broke every 2 miles. London, of course, was not like that, but nothing else resembled London, except Paris, which was just over half its size. Almost all European towns and cities in the mid-18th century were crumbling building sites. In any case, the population of London was greater than the total population of Scotland. As for music, there were no dedicated concert halls, in our sense, anywhere in Europe. People who gathered specifically to listen to music, at home or in church or at public ceremonies, were the very same people as those who made it. This meant that interest in what was done was closely tied to concern for how it was done. Indeed, every musical society in Europe required its members to perform at regular stages in the year. The so-called amateur musician was only later displaced by the emergence of skilled professional players when they began to travel to urban centres. The burgeoning bourgeois classes, with both money and leisure to spend it, eagerly responded to the pyrotechnics of these new players, as indeed did composers. But there was something else which we tend to forget today. Until well into the 1860s, music was extremely expensive to print, and performers typically played from incomplete handwritten scores. Every performer was expected to improvise. Improvisation defined both the nature and quality of almost all forms of public music making up to as late as 1900. All the most admired singers, instrumentalists, and organists were famous for their improvisatory skills. Bach, Handel, and Mozart, to name only a few. So your obvious question, why on earth did I start talking about music, has a three-part answer. Because in the 18th century, music was anchored in everyday life, it involved participation by everyone, and it required improvisation. And all three characteristics also define conversation. The supreme quality of improvisation is propriety, fitness for purpose. And the factor which conditions propriety is context. Improvisation presupposes extensive preparation, a good memory of the available repertoire, and intense concentration on the present, momentarily extinguishing its temporality. It is the ultimate art which disguises art. In a music masterclass today, as in the past, and as in Asian cultures, the pupil is already expected to be skilled in execution, and even more skilled in ability to discern how the master excels. It is absolutely inadmissible to mimic or imitate the master. The task for pupils is to adapt their insights to their own capacities. When we think about any aspect of social behaviour and practice, the central topics to address are performance, improvisation, propriety, and context. These all demand engagement of the mind, exercise of judgment, and a grasp of the specific skills needed in the context. This is the essence of conversation. It is an art which must be learned and constantly practiced. Improvisation is at its core, because success, even its existence, depends upon adaptation to the changing context. A context which is being influenced by the conversation itself. It's always proper to record appreciation. I really enjoyed our conversation. That indicates that a future conversation would also be welcomed. As children, we're all taught not to blurt out whatever comes into our heads, because we can easily say the wrong thing, use the wrong words, set the wrong tone, miss the right moment. In my own privileged schooling during and immediately after the war, we were taught and practiced at every meal the duties and rights of social conversation. And such familiar ideas lie behind my proposed definition. Conversation is a sacred practice in which the duty to listen precedes the right to speak. Conversation is a sacred practice in which the duty to listen precedes the right to speak. Let me explain. Conversation is a practice because it requires a range of learnable skills which must be used or lost. It is sacred because it embodies and conveys the values of the community in which it operates. The duty to listen underlines the necessity of judging the context before being able to estimate what might be appropriate behaviour. It also emphasises the central role of manners in conversation, in which courtesy to others takes precedence over assertion of oneself. The right to speak is earned, but is also circumscribed by the requirement of appropriateness. Instruction to children to wait their turn, not to interrupt, not to hog the conversation, just listen to what's being said. All such guidance dwells on such matters. We have to be sensitive to the knowledge, attention span, and interest of the listener, not to become boring, insistent, intrusive, upsetting, offensive. All matters concerning how others see us, which was Adam Smith's famous point in 1759 about learning to see ourselves as others see us. He also said in the same place, on the same date, "The great pleasure of conversation and society arises from a correspondence of sentiments and opinions, from a certain harmony of minds, which, like so many musical instruments, coincide and keep time with one another." The analogy between the improvisatory character of both conversation and music was commonplace by his day, because the emphasis was upon close attention to context, without which there can be no appropriateness. No Scots fiddler at the dance, no folk singer, no piper ever stuck to the minimal scores available. Similarly, properly educated and engaged conversationalists improvise throughout their performance, which will be centrally coloured by their breathing, their posture and facial expression, as well as by their vocabulary, pace, gesture, tone, rhythm, pitch, volume. I once gave a lecture in Kansas City, and there was a very beautiful woman in the front row who kept smiling at me all the way through the lecture. This was slightly disconcerting, until I decided that she must about to be a fellow guest at dinner, which I decided was going to be a very good thing indeed. And sure enough, she came up to me immediately at the end of the lecture, and she said, "I didn't understand a word you said." All of the ideas that I've just canvassed were explicitly discussed in 17th and 18th century France, and the overriding premise that one's duty was to perform appropriately in the theatre of social life also emphasised that success depended as much on sensitivity to the context as on rational reflection on the content of thought. In fact, most of the salon espoused a view that was more prominently canvassed by the Scottish than by French philosophers, namely that human beings are motivated by and respond to their feelings rather than to pure reasoning. We are first and last emotional beings. Now, you may well feel that what I've just described is absurdly formal, self-conscious, artificial, and thereby unnatural, indefensible, and unnecessary. Well, it is artificial in a strict sense, but it's most certainly not unnecessary. And it was the cornerstone of educational curricula in Western Europe for 2,000 years, under the name of rhetoric. This was the core of every curriculum in Europe, remained so in Scotland until the 19th century, and here in the agrarian south well into the 20th. Although the word rhetoric is now a term of abuse, it was properly a technical term covering a vast range of disciplines, including communication and behavior, moral philosophy and politics, psychology and economics, sociology and civic study. But its virtue and its vice were arguably one and the same. By trying to maintain a whole approach to life, it tried to do too much, and all its constituent parts went their separate ways into different disciplines. Now, we should never waste energy by being sentimental about a past which few of us would enjoy if we went there from here. But there are lessons to be learned from past successes, and by reflecting on what might be adaptable or enhanced for our present context, we can address some of our own problems. The justification of hindsight is that it can animate foresight. So let me enlarge on some of the things I've said. Conversation cannot take place among a large group of people. The family provides the natural scale. And without special measures, most cultures have found that groups over 20 are too large. Renaissance writers thought that 9 was the maximum number. The central reason for advocating the family scale is that everyone in a conversation is a participant, whether or not they actually speak on a given occasion. Indeed, in a proper conversation, silences are essential and have different characters. A second reason is that conversations are most often practiced when sharing the very essentials of life, food. Children learn and absorb much from family meals. And for adults, too, there is inestimable value in congenial conversation in cafes and bars. In London, from the 1680s, coffee shops and taverns became the centre for new forms of social gatherings, with lively gossip, discussion, and the exchange of news among a section of the literate and merchant classes. But two things should be underlined about this fact. The proportion of London's population that could afford to enjoy such pleasures was minute, and the practices of London, although widely publicised, were never fully replicated elsewhere. Moreover, although a small coterie in Scotland were as influenced as anyone else by Addison's essays on polite society of the 1710s, what could and did happen in Scotland differed markedly from what happened in London or Paris. And for that reason, what happened in Scotland had greater influence in America. To the Scots, the whole point of knowledge was use and benefit. And I'll come back to that in a minute. In addition to what I've said, formal dining is especially important at certain stages of society. In French salon for over a century, it called for self-conscious preparation by host and guest and bequeathed a legacy which properly enriches Western culture. Who might appropriately sit with whom? What topics might be appropriate for conversation? With whom and when? Why some issues might be best avoided or diverted? All the concerns with which you are entirely familiar today. If we treat conversation as a genus, then its species include discussion, argument, and debate. These notions have their own histories and their own proprieties. One strand of Western thought, often attributed to Aristotle, is that serious people should engage primarily in inquiry after the truth. This was supposed to indicate that debate is what matters, and that from a properly constructed debate, a winner emerges. More sharply, those who were attracted to legal procedures held that argument should take priority, and in argument, winning is what matters, whether or not the winner arrives at the truth. Such notions bedevil present-day practice. Politicians and journalists oscillate between argument and debate, but very rarely engage in conversation with anyone. In recent decades, some Western scholars have become interested in a Japanese tradition which seeks to avoid loss of face on the one hand and to achieve consensus rather than submission to a victor on the other. It's called the both-and approach. It is assumed that every speaker has some insight to offer, and that in any complex matter, the resulting diversity of understanding must be accommodated. So the response is, yes, you're right, and there is also this to consider. But you'll probably ask what people are going to talk about under my umbrella of conversation, and what it's got to do with a desirable society. The answer is that people can and should talk about all those matters which are of value to the society that they wish to enjoy, including the practical means for implementing appropriate action. In other words, conversation as such has no necessary association with random musings, casual thought, or indeterminate abstractions. Indeed, discussion is the best species of conversation for cementing society, because rules of participation, engagement, and focus can readily be agreed among participating members. And this is precisely what happened throughout Western Europe and dramatically in Scotland in the 18th century. Let me remind you of a few details and introduce it with a phrase which may help to underline its modern relevance. It's my belief that in every society at all times, we must commit ourselves and society must commit itself to costing values. That is, to identifying the resources necessary for endorsing and the sacrifices necessary for implementing the values to which we are committed. Some years ago, I interviewed in the privacy of their own residences several heads of state and national leaders. And the single question with which we always began after dinner was this: are there people in your state or nation who regularly and effectively articulate, review, revise, and cost the fundamental values of your society, and subsequently communicate and uphold them? All my hosts strongly supported the question, and everyone regretted that there was nobody. Discussion societies, as I said, had sprung up throughout Europe since the early 1600s. By the 1730s, they even existed in most Scottish towns, the population of which, except for Edinburgh, rarely exceeded 5,000. The members met in rented tavern rooms, often under the banner of improvement, and they self-consciously sought to embody the intellectual aspects of the French salon. This signified that they'd discuss any matters which might even indirectly improve the health and wealth of the nation. As I said, knowledge was to be for use. Many such groups dedicated themselves to the special interests of their members. The three central topics in Edinburgh around the 1750s were agriculture, mining, and banking. But the range of topics was sometimes extensive. It's worth noting that the dominant subjects were, in two later contexts, 50 and 100 years later. For example, in the Friendly Club of New York City, which met almost daily between 1793 and 1798, the topics were David Hume on parties and religion, the style of David Hume and William Robertson, Godwin's political justice, distribution of crime, justice and punishment, and St. Pierre's theory of tides. In the Baltimore Monday Club between 1851 and 1859, that's 100 years after the Scottish ones, 100 years, the topics were Kossuth, fossil animals, political machinery, women's rights, Judaism, the causes and remedy of juvenile depravity, expediency as a principle of action, the destiny of Negroes in the South, marriage and the Mormons, right of property, right of secession, and taxation. In the Edinburgh clubs in the 1750s, a good deal of drinking occurred. So strict rules govern behaviour, attendance, and indeed the numbers. Attendance was mandatory because participation was of the essence. Moderate behaviour was mandatory. Its contrary, heavily fined. First of all, the cost of the whole evening, then the cost of the next three meetings, and finally expulsion. And no club exceeded 30 members. The topics were decided by consensus, several meetings in advance, as were the introductory speaker, chairman, and recording secretary for each meeting. Members often presented reports of what we would call work in progress, their own experience or experiments. Because the membership of all these clubs overlapped socially and were wide opportunities for the exchange of information and viewpoint. In Edinburgh, as on the continent of Europe, intellectual life was grounded on and sustained by conversation. The vitality of such groups depended, of course, on the vitality of their leadership and the members. And the average lifetime of most discussions clubs was actually only a few years, except that I'm a member of two of them, which have been going for 250. In the 1750s, the 50,000 citizens who crammed into the 140 acres of the crumbling medieval city of Edinburgh constituted an integrated society in which rich and poor lived together in all the 15-story apartments. This last architectural detail was relevant to social cohesion because Edinburgh, as I've already said, was twice the size of any other town in Britain except London. And one might add that when buildings of that height re-emerged almost 200 years later, none of the social cohesion resulted. Just to get things in perspective, the figures I've given you for 1750, namely 50,000 folk in Edinburgh, were not achieved in any American city. The population of Savannah in 1800 and of Charleston were both under 5,000 of the non-slave population, and they only reached Edinburgh's size in 1900. The largest southern city at the turn of the century, 1800, the largest southern city was Baltimore, which had reached 80,000 by 1830. In Edinburgh in 1750, the configuration of the town, the architecture, and the conduct of life ensured that at some level, most people recognized most others, and regular converse was witnessed by all. Evening conversations were often renewed at length the next day at the Market Cross or nearby stalls. And there lies another clue. For centuries throughout Europe, the markets and town squares, the piazzas, plazas, and place were the location for the exchange of produce and of equal importance of news, gossip, and opinion. Markets were the sources of conversation and the means by which people of all ages and station could meet and socialize. In the beautiful cathedral city of Salisbury, where I spent every summer of my youth, the market dates from 1200, and until long after the Second War, folk might take half a day to get to market and half a day to get home. There could be no rush. The horses were tired, or there was only one country bus. The antisocial tyranny of the car has annihilated one ingredient of such cherished and needed gatherings, the unself-conscious passing of time with neighbours. Time was not yet money, and when speed was not an option, haste was not on the agenda. A small step, I think, in recent decades has been the resurrection of farmers' markets in large cities, which can provoke us at least into thinking what we should do to animate civic engagement. So, we have small market-centered communities amongst whom there are citizens self-consciously reflecting on the values they wish to uphold and who can seek the views or assistance of anyone else in the community who might be able to contribute to the overall welfare. Other locally centered activities also invite and encourage participation in matters of health, education, care of the elderly, as well as in sports, music, theatre, and the appearance of town or village. In agrarian communities, some participation in social activity is almost unavoidable. Even if religious festivals provide fewer bonding occasions than formerly, farming is seasonal, children grow, villages have to share and cooperate over many matters. By contrast, passivity, disengagement, non-participation sit easily alongside the anonymity so easily available within giant cities. These aspects of large city life can especially disadvantage the young, who, if uncertain of work in small communities, are enticed by the apparently untrammeled freedoms of the city. Now, I've several times mentioned the term culture. By that term, I do not only mean Raphael and Rachmaninoff, opera, ballet, and Greek tragedy. Under the term culture, I include all the elements which contribute to the values upheld within a given society. Dress and sport, food and drink, sexual behaviour and dance, gardens, churches, operas, theatres. Don't forget the countless Greek and Roman theatres located throughout southern Europe. But upholding values entails doing something. Cultural commitment means activity, not passivity. Town agricultural shows, seasonal displays, religious festivals, pagan ceremonies, annual sports competitions all constitute the cultures of smaller communities. Only 20th century living has dissociated cultural activities from the practice of living a whole life. Almost every small Italian town had a theatre which also functioned as an opera house in the 18th century. This was because music was part of everyday life and was experienced daily in church. Moreover, the opera season constituted the social gathering place for the whole community, from servants to nobles. And the preferred comic operas were topical, social or political satires which seamlessly integrated with everything else. Just as the frescoes and sculptures were part of the church fabric, so music, feasts, processions, dress, adornment, spectacle and food were part of the processes of civic life. City dwellers in the Western world too easily narrow their notion of culture to mean high art, associated with a kind of secular priesthood of aesthetes. The decontextualized, albeit wonderful, displays in our great museums very rarely enhance cultural understanding of our inheritance. But they do promote a lubricious interest in the monetary costs. The legacies of Christ the King, we might say, have been upstaged by the achievements of Christie's the auctioneers. To minimize such responses, it's helpful to think of almost everything we now encounter in museums not as physical objects, but as elements abstracted from events or processes in which everyday lives were embedded. The closest analogy today would be with the colourful and noisy Indian village festivals, which attract and reward all the senses. It's no accident that the truly vibrant areas of vast Western cities today are often those inhabited by ethnic minorities who celebrate their own seasonal festivals with commitment and energy. It's also notable that the few giant cities which have retained or re-established some coherence and vitality have invariably done so through almost autonomous constituent villages, the village and elsewhere in New York, Hampstead or Chelsea in London. Boorish urban academics, from whom we naturally exclude ourselves, loudly deride good manners as artificial masks which inhibit self-expression and engender social deceit. As usual, like the Rousseau of the new Héloïse, whom they cite as inspiration, they miss the point. Tolstoy's rejection of social role-playing as inhibiting rested on his view that the contingencies and complexities of life cannot be covered by simplified behavioural conventions. Of course, hypocrisy is despicable and the social chameleon untrustworthy, but extremes never disqualify the norm. What counts as good manners is always culturally and contextually anchored, because, as I've insisted, propriety is always their criterion. Manners are contrived to meet perceived needs and goals. They must be learned and practiced, and they rarely evolve at the same rate as other social changes, which is why they're often described as old-fashioned. But the history and justification of all manners can be explained, although the task is undertaken too infrequently. Manners have nothing to do with snobbery, although snobbery always claims social superiority and acceptance for one fashion rather than another. But if improvisation functions as a criterion of conversation, it operates even more obviously in the domain of manners. I must emphasize two more factors. Nothing I've said about manners implies ineffectiveness or impracticality. A second feature of manners was famously captured by a French scholar in 1749 in the phrase, often cited, "Le style, c'est l'homme même." Le style, c'est l'homme même. Now, later generations outside France have totally misunderstood this saying. It's got nothing to do with the colour of your shirt, the car of your choice, or your handbag. On the contrary, this ancient concept of style, as always, derived from classical rhetoric, and it claims that the style summarizes one's philosophy of life and the behavior it entailed. To use the mariner's expression, the cut of his jib. Good manners are rightly celebrated as an essential cement in small communities. Manners matter when participants know each other. The abuse of good manners in cities is deplorable because without cement, no social structure can bond. Urban anomie, so widely described by 19th century novelists, results from the absence of personal encounter, conversation, and shared cultural practice. But, you will say, I still don't see why conversation is a cement. The answer lies in the ultimate moral duty, which is to think. The expectation and possibility of conversation within a group and the acquired skills to conduct it enable participants to explore, refine, express, and finally act upon coherent, intelligible, justifiable thoughts. Only by expressing their thoughts can human beings come to know what they really are. Expression is a necessary condition of thought. Well, what about silent thought, you will ask? Or all those great ideas that I've had and didn't express? What about mute, inglorious Miltons? Well, first of all, silent thought is a highly sophisticated development which presupposes articulated thought. You can keep it to yourself only because you can control what you first have to do, namely to express it. And as to the great ideas that you didn't express, sorry, but they didn't exist. There's a very nice question by a little boy. How can I tell what I think until I see what I say? Encouraging people to think is the first duty of education. But many factors can atrophy that capacity, and when they do, society becomes dysfunctional. Thinking requires practice. Sustained thinking is tiring, but choosing not to think is the ultimate immoral act. And those who seek power typically aim to relieve the rest of us of the need to think. In agrarian societies, as elsewhere, it is entirely possible, of course, to be a recluse or a hermit, to opt out, withdraw, sit on the sidelines. But it's a great deal easier to do this in the anonymity of large towns. Moreover, in smaller communities generally, neighbours know each other and are expected to fulfil reciprocal duties and rights. Neighbourly behaviour demands thought, and all thought demands expression. The conversations in smaller societies, no matter how limited in scope or circumscribed in ambition, are critical to their survival. Moreover, when the scale of context is such that everyone knows what others think, extremes of reaction are less likely, toleration more likely, mutual interest and respect can be promoted, and social tensions minimised. In recent decades, and quite widely throughout the world, politicians have canvassed the idea of national conversations about education or health or anything else. The idea is absurd. And it results from the same kind of sloppy thinking that sponsored the notion of multicultured societies. There can't be a multicultured society because a culture in the singular is simply the whole set of values and practices within an identifiable group. In the mathematical sense, it is the set of all sets. What should have been said was that an existing set can be enriched or impoverished as their constituents change or evolve. When peoples from one context enter another, both groups change together with the resultant culture. How and why, of course, are important questions. But the verbal laziness of politicians in such matters exempts both them and their listeners from thinking. One significant feature of Southern culture, which Northern historians erased, has recently been excavated and celebrated. The deeply European roots of Southern education, thinking and artistic endeavour, was never matched in the North with equal commitment. I refer especially to the combination of relaxed intellectualism and relentless sceptical inquiry. In the South, as in much of Europe, life was to be lived. And the agreeableness of living depended ultimately on matters of taste, as the ancients had declared. Mind and body, thought and emotion had to be aesthetically harmonized, a notion that was in the process of being debased by urban intellectuals. Nevertheless, besides insistence on wholeness, holism in today's jargon, went an understanding that our grasp of nature's complexity was always incomplete, and the material values warranted no respect as ends in themselves. The insistent dogmas elsewhere of taming nature, accumulating wealth, proclaiming strident exceptionalism, was profoundly vulgar and distasteful. But taste is not an optional extra. Tragically, mere disassociation from practices inimical to a good life is never an effective defence against Philistine imperialism. Even if, and it's extremely doubtful, even if the relatively poor and weak are content with their lot, they are always vulnerable to stronger predators. That's why the return of powers by centralized governments to small states and autonomous regions always carry threats about the burdens of defending their values. No one in the agrarian South has argued or did argue that towns as such are inimical to the values they uphold. Indeed, towns of appropriate scales are necessary and evolve at different rates in different contexts. And it was soon realized that reflection on the growth, planning, and configuration of towns, which had excited Renaissance minds, would be beneficial. As an historical fact, all building is expensive, and function always takes priority over appearance, even in churches and displays of power. But if something doesn't work, its mere appearance rarely compensates. The growth and planning of early southern towns is worthy of close study, alongside the ideas of collegiality in the early university campuses. Jefferson, for example, was greatly inspired by contemporary neoclassical French designs, although his ideas were also unavoidably coloured by the monastic legacy in Oxford and Cambridge and the urban practices of the great continental institutions such as Milan and Pisa. The holistic humanistic goals of all these institutions, however imperfectly realised, were anchored in spaces, places, times and practices on a human scale. The buildings could have been bigger, the spaces grander, the courses longer, the numbers greater, and indeed the internal politics less vicious. Nevertheless, almost insensibly, but not of course unconsciously, judgment was tempered by scale and propriety, constrained most certainly by economic matters, but animated by deep conviction that among the primary duties were the understanding, cherishing, refining, and promoting of inherited traditions. British events in the last decade or so, such as the abandonment of the national anthem at graduation, or of academic processions as politically incorrect, or the use of titles as socially divisive, or standards of politeness, dress, and punctuality as class-based prejudices, such idiocies would have been inconceivable to our ancestors. The humanistic values cherished in the South and parts of Europe were grounded in duties, not rights. They celebrated the development of the individual, of course, but not to promote egoism, which always identifies service with servitude. On the contrary, the goal was to engender responsibility to others. This entailed judging the nature of the context and determining what behaviour would be suitable or appropriate to what already exists. The notions of scale and propriety, which I've so often mentioned, derive as much from the classical world of architecture as from moral philosophy and rhetoric. And without delving into scholarly detail here, I strongly recommend reflection on the opening chapters of Vitruvius's 10 books on architecture, where he explains all his terms and criteria, and also the similar passages by his ungenerous but learned critic, Leon Battista Alberti, writing 1500 years later. In both cases, emphasis is on proportion and appearance, and refers always to the particularities of the diverse contexts in which the performance can be perceived and judged. Leadership in the realms of value and tradition must start in the home and in educational establishments. But we have a dismal record over recent decades. If we are committed to upholding a civil society which we can understand and can explain, we must at the same time commit ourselves to the appropriate scales of practice. These scales may refer to the number of participants involved, the size of institutions or places needed, the time periods necessary for implementation, the kinds of training necessary for effective participation. All of this is involved in costing our values. None of it, as such, involves rejection of economic matters, repudiation of towns, refusal to adopt the benefits of appropriate technology, It's nothing to do with burying our heads in the sand, sentimentally lamenting the days of yore. It is to place human beings, in all their complexity, at the core of discussion and the centre of any social proposals. Human beings, not money, not material goods, not political power, not abstract ideas. In brief, the moral domain is a theatre of conversations in which the context contributes to the performance as much as the mood, the skills, and the journeys of the participants. The context, that is, society, must be cherished and tended with the utmost care and energy, because in a world of constant change, the scale and proportions of all things shift. The condition, the strength, the appearance of the bonding cement must regularly be checked. And why? Because le style, c'est l'homme même. Thank you.